For the week of February 10th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 437, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
Birmingham, Alabama, so you went back south.
I am down south, yes. We celebrated my mom's 90th birthday. I'm here for a few weeks. I'll be back in New York in mid-March. And I'm here all the time. I don't care where I am, all over the world. I am always prepared to do the show. I believe in our listeners, and I will be there for them 52 weeks a year. I don't care where I am or what's happening. I will always be there to make sure we have a show.
You know what I really need right now is the cricket sound effect.
Mm-hmm. Sperling will not be here next week, thus no show.
Yes, correct. That is effectively what Michael is trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Where will you be next week?
I will be in New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand.
Oh, very fun.
Yes.
Well, tell the hobbits I said hello.
I will. You know, I'm pretty sure that that's a stereotype, by the way.
I don't know. I think that's where they're actually from. But anyway, that's where you'll be next week. This is where I am right now. What are we going to talk about on the show?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're still celebrating our Grammy win for Best Comedy Podcast. Amazing.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah. Yeah. We thought we were doing a news entertainment podcast, but we'll take it. Okay. Actually, we didn't win a Grammy, but we will see if there's anything to be learned from who did win a Grammy. And Michael will share a link to his annual picks for the best albums of the year. Spoiler alert, you heard some of the same names last night during the Grammy telecast. We still feel like winners, however, because our guest this week is the head of Cinemia, the new MoviePass competitor that wants to boldly go where no movie subscription service has gone before, profitability. We'll be talking with Rafat Oyuz about the launch of the service, how they chose their $30 price point, and what lies ahead for this new business. If it catches on, it could dramatically change when and how often people go to the movies. We'll catch up with him during Inside Baseball. In sexual misconduct news, Woody Allen is suing Amazon for ending his movie deal over baseless, decades-old allegations. Turning to another disaster story in Book Filter news, Michael will be sharing his pick of the week, the hilarious new nonfiction book about the nuclear meltdown at Chernobyl. What? I should read these before I read these. He'll explain. He better explain. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times, you, our listener. And what you're telling us this week is Happy New Year, because it is the year of the pig. And that means in China and throughout Asia, there are a lot of big new movies opening up. That's where all the story is right now. North America had a moribund weekend at the box office. China had a massive one. And the number one movie around the world is The Wandering Earth. This is based on a short story by acclaimed science fiction writer Liu Cixin, and it had great word of mouth. This was pushed as the first big budget Chinese sci-fi movie, you know, a movie that could stand toe-to-toe with Star Wars and Star Trek and all the Marvel movies, and it has paid off. Great word of mouth for this movie. It started off in third place on Tuesday. Tuesday was when a lot of these movies opened up. So we've got figures for the weekend, but the total amount is going to be a lot bigger. So over the three-day weekend, The Wandering Earth made $170 million, but its total is $290 million. That's because of all the money it made Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So after about 5 days, The Wandering Earth has made $290 million. I think the budget might be $50 million. So this is a huge success story. We'll have to see how it does in other parts of the world. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. Another big Chinese movie is number two, of course, Crazy Alien. This is the third in sort of a loose franchise, or really just sort of a branded series of broad comedies. This made $78 million on the weekend. It's at $215 million worldwide. This movie was number one on Tuesday. It made $100 million in 2 days. It was tearing it up. It hasn't fallen off a cliff. Word of mouth isn't bad, but Wandering Earth kept doing better and better every day, and that's why that one is on top. Crazy Alien is about a monkey trainer, I think, and his monkey gets injured when an alien crash lands where he is, and so he trains the alien instead to do the act, and hilarity ensues. Here's the weird thing. I think it stars Matthew Morrison of Glee.
Yes.
Yes, bizarre. But this is the third in a franchise. The first one was called Crazy Stone, and the second was called Crazy Racer, and now we moved on to Crazy Alien. At number three around the world is the first movie not pushing it out at the Chinese box office. It's the Lego Movie 2, the second part. $53 million on its opening weekend. The reviews have been mixed. Everybody pretty much said not as funny as the first Lego movie. And of course, it's the fourth in the franchise. We had the Lego movie, which got great reviews. Then we had the Lego Ninjago, Lego Batman. So really, it's sort of franchise fatigue and the fact that this one didn't deliver. Everybody's a little bit disappointed in it, but it'll probably be okay when all is said and done. But it did make $53 million on its opening weekend in 64 territories. At number four around the world, it's back to China, where Pegasus is another solid hit. This movie made $52 million on the weekend, but it's at $150 million since opening up on Tuesday. This is a movie directed by Han Han, who is a very famous blogger and race car driver. He's done everything. He's like, you know, Superman in China. And it's a comedy, actually, about a race car driver making a comeback. So that's a world he knows well, and the movie has delivered. And number five around the world is How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. That made another $38 million on the weekend. It's at $140 million worldwide. And number six is a James Cameron-produced sci-fi flick. It's Alita, Battle Angel. It opened in 11 territories, and it did very well in all of them, it looks like. $32 million on its opening weekend. But this is a very expensive movie, so it's going to have to really pull it up in the United States and China. From the trailers, I honestly don't think it's going to.
Yeah, well, I mean, I saw about 20 minutes, 25 minutes of it, and it was very disjointed, so I can't tell you narratively whether it will work. It looked amazing, meaning that the visuals were amazing at times. So other than that, I couldn't tell you.
But, you know, that's my gut instinct based on the trailer, but it's James Cameron. It's a very famous property, and it's doing very well in the territories it's opened up, so I may very well be wrong. At number seven around the world, back to China, Boonie Bears, Blast into the Past. This is an inexpensive animated film. It's the sixth in a series. It made $27 million on the weekend. It's at just about $70 million, which means definitely well into profitability for that movie. And they did much better than Peppa Pig. A big push for Peppa Pig in China, saying Peppa Pig celebrates the new year. Appropriate, since it's the year of the pig. But Peppa Pig did not work. Though it's a popular series and property in China, I believe, it did not click at the movies for that particular movie. At number eight, we're back to North America, basically. It's What Men Want, starring Taraji P. Henson. It's a remake of the Mel Gibson film from like 10 or 20 years ago, and it's just as witless as What Women Want was way back then. $20 million on its opening weekend, however, so it made back its budget on its opening weekend. That's always a good sign. At number nine is Extreme Job. This is the Korean comedy about cops who open up a chicken restaurant. It's a front for a sting operation. It made $18 million on the weekend. That's at $75 million worldwide. At number 10 is Green Book, the Viggo Mortensen film and Mahershala Ali, which is getting a lot of momentum thanks to Oscar nominations. Sometimes it really does work, and it's worked for this one. $15 million on the weekend. It's at $106 million worldwide. A few other really big films in China. At number 11 is The New King of Comedy. This is the Stephen Chow remake of his 1999 film, I should say. The original was about a male aspiring actor. This remake is about a female aspiring actor. It made $15 million on the weekend. It's at $80 million total. And one more movie from China. Oh, Jackie Chan did not have a great week. He actually has a cameo in one of those big movies, but the movie he stars in is Night of Shadows between Yin and Yang, and that has not done well. It's a family-friendly comedy. It made $4 million over the weekend, so it's clearly falling fast. That's at $22 million total. And another movie that opened up in the Chinese New Year is Integrity. This one has fallen off the charts completely. It's a Hong Kong flick with a lot of veteran action stars, but it did not click with audiences. A couple new movies is Cold Pursuit. That's way up there at number 12. This is the Liam Neeson action film with the worst PR tour ever.
Oh, my God. Oh, yay, yay. I mean, Liam Neeson could not have done a Oh, he just stepped.
They're like, is this the time you decide to share the embarrassing, awful story? You know, good Lord, couldn't you have waited?
Yeah.
But it made $13 million on its opening weekend. And I think that's all the news worldwide. The Favorite's at $70 million worldwide. That's doing great. Here in North America, I think that's all the big news.
That is all the big news. Now, you mentioned The Favorite, which I thought was a favorite. I thought this was a favorite to win the BAFTAs. And yet, no.
No, it's Roma. Roma. So the award season continues. All the more craft awards came out. I feel like the message is still very mixed. The BAFTAs have a few people in common with the Oscars. They do, I think, the same sort of balloting. They've been sort of in sync in the last few years. And if they are, that means Roma might win Best Picture and Director and Cinematography at one and Best Foreign Language Film. So Roma won big at the BAFTAs. The Favorite won the most awards, 7 in all. So they loved that film as well. But Roma triumphed. Who's going to win the Oscars? I have no idea.
Well, and because of the preferential ballot, who knows? I still think Roma might have a shot here. And here's why. Because everybody will pick it as their number two. They will say, well, I don't want a streaming film that has no box office, no public box office to win. So I will pick, The Favorite is number one, or, you know, Star is Born is number one. And I'll put Roma as number two.
Yeah, I don't think so. I feel a lot of backlash against the movie. A lot of people seeing it going, no, it's not that good. But that's me. I just didn't like it. So maybe that's just my prejudice. However, I feel like, this is not the movie that's going to break the curse. I feel like momentum has fallen by the wayside for it in terms of box office and attention and notice and people talking about it. I feel it's fallen a little bit off the radar.
Well, box office, we don't know what box office is. So,
well, yes, that's exactly. But there was some attention, people speculating and trying to figure it out and talk about it. So that was interesting. But again, when you don't publish your figures, you don't get that press. If Roma was tearing it up at the box office and people were flocking to it, then I would feel like, well, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, and I always find it odd. And by the way, the same is true of the Academy Awards. When every envelope that opens has The Favorite in it, for instance. But the best film of the year is not The Favorite. You know, it wins acting, writing, directing. Well, not directing, but, it wins all of these other awards. And yet, it's not the best movie of the year.
Well, we don't have to wonder who's going to win at the Grammy Awards because they took place last night. We're recording our show on Monday this week. And the Grammy winners are in. Alicia Keys was the host. About 20 million people showed up. A smidge higher than last year, which was the lowest in like a decade.
Well, wait a second. We should say they did not show up at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. They showed up on television.
The audience was tuned in. Yes. What else am I talking about?
You're talking about all the
stars who couldn't be bothered to show up?
Well, okay, them too. Yes. They didn't show up at the Staples Center either.
Oh, that was a joke. I beg your pardon. I had no idea you were trying to make a joke. Anyway, there are two things to talk about the Grammy Awards. One are the actual awards. The other is the actual show and what kind of a show they put on. In terms of awards, wow, it was a big year. A lot of women won. Almost half of the 86 awards handed out were won by women. Well over a third. So that's a big change. That's never happened before. I couldn't see any year even remotely close to that. A woman won for Best Engineer for the first time ever. That's exciting. All the big awards were won by women. All the big album awards, Best Americana Album, Best Rap Album, Best R&B Album, Best Country Album, and Album of the Year were all won by women. The one award that wasn't won by them, Best New Artist, also a woman. The one that wasn't were Song of the Year and Record of the Year, but that was won by hip hop for the first time in history. So when women weren't making history, hip hop was making history. So if you look at the awards, even though they aren't the people I would pick in each category, they're all respectable. There are no groaners, a lot of women. And finally, hip hop won a big top award in Record and Song of the Year. That was This Is America by Childish Gambino, which should have won Best Video of the Year and maybe Best Record, but it's not a Song of the Year. But that's because they still don't understand the difference.
Yes, well, that is true. The people voting on it still don't understand the difference. And we had a little conversation, and I made the joke that, you know what, it almost seems like, you know, nobody's voting for these. The Academy just picks the people that they think
Why are you saying that? What are you talking about?
Well, because, you know, it turns out that last year, Neil Portnow, the head of the Academy, he stood on stage and he messed up big time. He said to women, hey, you know, we're here. It's time for you to step up. And basically
He was a jerk, but that wasn't just that one time. He has a history of not being proactive with women, and it wasn't on the show. It was on a press conference afterwards or whatever. But anyway, he was a fool. And then on the show last night, he did a tribute to himself and had artists praising him, showing how tone deaf he is and how he really does need to go.
Right, but it's like, oh, you've got a women problem and a hip hop problem. Don't worry, we can solve that in 1 year.
Well, but that wasn't by them rigging the vote. It was by them choosing to have a female host with Alicia Keys and having a lot of female performers on the show from beginning to end. It was certainly a night dominated by women, both performance-wise and awards-wise. But the awards are not rigged. This was just a year that women won big.
I said that sarcastically, but...
Well, that wasn't clear to me.
Well, that said, one of the things my kids pointed out to me during the Dolly Parton tribute, where she was on stage singing... they pointed out, oh, wow, she can't really sing those songs anymore. I was like, yes, that's what happens when you're 73, 75 years old. And number one. And number two is that Taylor Swift wasn't there, a big country artist. She started out as a country artist. You would have thought she would have been there.
Well, a lot of acts were missing in action. They're starting to look like the Super Bowl where nobody wants to bother to show up. The hip hop community, I think, just feels completely dissed and ignored and treated like dirt, and they're sick of it and they're done with it. They're not showing up. They don't want to perform. They don't want to sit in the audience. They're just not there. No Jay-Z, no Beyonce, no Kanye. Drake showed up, and that was a surprise that he was actually there, but God forbid he perform. No Kendrick Lamar, on and on and on. A lot of big stars, including Taylor Swift and Donald Glover. I almost said Danny Glover. God forgive me. Donald Glover, aka Childish Gambino, he couldn't be bothered to show up. Maybe some of them had reasons other than saying they couldn't be bothered and don't like the Grammys, but that's certainly what it feels like, and it's a big problem.
Why was Drake behind? He was backstage when he won his award. He came, and I thought, oh, he must be performing. No, he didn't. I couldn't figure out why he was backstage.
So we had the show. There were some good performances. The show was okay. I think perhaps because so many big celebrities did not want to show up or perform, and they had the problem with Ariana Grande, maybe that's the reason there were so many darn tributes. It felt like half the show was an in memoriam segment or, looking back to the past rather than celebrating the best new music of the year. There were 18 official performances. 6 of them were tributes or covers of classics.
Now you mentioned the Ariana Grande problem. Do you want to kind of...
Well, everybody knows she wanted to perform. They wanted to have her, but they couldn't agree with her on what she should do. She wanted to do her big new hit number one song, and they're like, no. And then they finally said, well, okay, but we get to pick the second one. It was just how absurd that you cannot come to an agreement with Ariana Grande and let her do her big new song. Cardi B did her big new hit. Why couldn't Ariana Grande? It's crazy. And then they dissed her publicly and they mocked her and they were attacking her, which is doubly absurd. Even if you're in the right, you should not be publicly attacking an artist. You shut up and you say, we love her and we're so sorry we couldn't make it happen and we're so sorry we hurt her feelings and we love and respect her. That's all you do. You never publicly attack an artist. That is absurd of the producer to do that. He should be fired.
Ken Ehrlich, good luck with that.
Absolutely, Ken Ehrlich should be fired. Absolutely. That's absurd. You're picking public battles with world-famous artists. You don't matter at all. Neil Portnow doesn't matter. Nobody wants to hear a tribute to Neil Portnow on the Grammys, but nobody had the courage to say, shut up and get off the stage. Unless you're going to go on there and say, I'm a jerk and I apologize, get away. Just shut up. Nobody wants to hear.
I'll be honest. I was surprised that he showed up.
He should not have showed up. And he had a tribute to himself. So it was absurd. Well, so there were a lot of performances. The biggest problem for me was the whole section of Motown. You've got Diana Ross coming on the show to celebrate her 75th birthday. Wonderful. She does 2 songs. Wonderful. It's quite a lengthy segment. Why the hell are you also having a Motown tribute? Forget that it's Jennifer Lopez, but why are you also doing a lengthy Motown? That's Diana Ross. That is a Motown tribute. And they're doing a Motown tribute in April. So why are you shoving extra Motown tributes into this night? Other than the fact that maybe they didn't have enough performances to fill, I just don't understand it. It was like 15 minutes of the show devoted to Motown. That's, I love Motown, but that's crazy.
Well, in regards to the Ariana Grande kerfuffle, if you will, I actually heard an interesting solution to that, which is, if you're going to be on the show and you're going to perform, okay, just make it one of the songs that's nominated or from an album that is nominated, which,
Cardi B. Well, that's a problem because you have Camille Cabello performing Havana, which came out in 2017. You have the even that felt like an oldie but a goodie. That's a two-year-old song, practically. It's a well over a year and a half. And that's been performed on a dozen other award shows. So, yeah, you don't always want the song that was nominated. And that's not a solution. You want the latest hot new music. Sometimes, and if you want the biggest star in the world, the woman with the number one album and song, maybe you want her to do her big new hit, not a song that came out a year ago. Because it's not always wise. So that's not a solution. The solution is to work with the artist and always bow to them, you know, unless they're asking for some crazy demand. And her demand was, I'd like to do my number one hit song, you know, brand new right now, this week, number one song in the country. And they were saying no. That's just insane.
Now, did you find that some of the performances were rather racy this year? You know, you had Janelle Monáe and then you had Cardi B kind of writhing around on stage.
St. Vincent with Dua Lipa.
I was just going to say.
That was sexy without any sort of writhing. That was just sexy. That was a sexual tension.
I was like, wow, are they dating? I'm confused.
It's called a performance. But there was a lot of lip syncing, which is a big problem. But, you know, there you go. The weird thing was... Well, I'll skip that till later. My question for you is, what was your musical highlight?
Oh, my musical highlight. I don't know. I didn't really have a big musical highlight. I thought the whole Shawn Mendes maybe with
Miley Cyrus. I don't know why it was a Miley Cyrus comeback night either. She was in two segments. That seemed bizarre.
Yeah, well, the Dolly Parton thing was good.
I thought the Dolly Parton segment was really good. It was quite long.
Yes.
I mean, I love Dolly Parton, and we just had a Music Cares tribute to her. And if you're going to have Diana Ross and Motown, and it's like, you know, one of them needs to go, and it should have been Motown. But I love Dolly Parton. I thought it was a good segment. It was bizarre that it was like five different songs. I actually really enjoyed it musically.
One of which, by the way, was not hers.
Well, no, it was a cover of Neil Young, but that was a tribute to her group Trio, one of the best-selling albums of her career with Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris. So I was delighted to see that, to them paying homage to arguably her best album. It's just a great masterpiece in my mind, Trio, that album with Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris. They're not capable of, Linda can't sing anymore because of illness, so they couldn't recreate that moment. So I thought that was a lovely thing to do a Neil Young song like that. And she did a new song. She did a new number, a new song. She's written 3,000 songs. She's like, here's a new one. And it was darn good, I thought.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. But my big moment of the Grammys, the performance I thought blew the roof off the house. I thought it wasn't even any doubt about the best performance of the night. I thought it was Brandi Carlile doing The Joke. I thought that was just a tremendous performance, great song, very good album. And I thought the reaction in the room was huge. It just felt like a really big triumphant moment for her. And I was glad she won three awards, you know, a couple of songs plus Americana as the best Americana album for her. By the way, I forgive you. So I thought that was the triumphant artistic moment of the night.
That seemed like a Mumford & Sons moment. And what I mean by that is Mumford & Sons was known to me, was known to you when they performed on the Grammys, but they weren't widely known. That moment when they took the stage at the Grammys and made, you know, did within the first year of their kind of their coming out party, so to speak, that was a big moment for them and really changed the course of their careers. And I thought that was very true of Brandi Carlile's moment yesterday with The Joke. I agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was the Grammys. And if you're interested at all, I have a link to my favorite albums of the year. I always do it right as the Grammys come up. That's sort of my personal deadline. A lot of music comes up through the end of the year and all the best of lists where I go, oh, wait, I haven't heard this one. I haven't heard that one. I try to catch up with some things I've missed. So if you're interested at all, check it out. We have a link in our show notes. I certainly had some music that was there last night. Janelle Monáe is on my list. Brandi Carlile, they're both in my top 10. Some people who should have been on the show, like Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, who won the Grammy for Best Jazz Vocal Album. They seem so afraid of classical and jazz now, they never put it on the air. She's one of the great jazz singers around. She's a terrific live performer. She would have been electric. Would have been a better choice than a tribute to Donny Hathaway, but whatever. So, you know, if you're interested, check it out.
Yeah, there were some performers. I was like, who is this? Who are these people? I kind of vaguely recognize
That's because you're not hip.
I'm not hip. No, I'm not hip. No. I'm not even hip enough to know what book I should be reading these days. And I know that you are. In fact, you read every book that comes out every single week. So every book. Yeah, on bookfilter.com, you then kind of like lay them all out each week and each month, and you say, hey, here are the books you should be reading right now. And every week, you kind of, or most weeks, I should say, you bring us a book that's kind of ready for its close-up, and maybe one that's ready for adaptation to a TV show or to a movie. What have you got for us this week?
This week, I've got a laugh riot of a book. It's Midnight in Chernobyl by Adam Higginbotham.
You know this what? I wish I had I needed my sound effects for crickets earlier.
Yeah. Well, you know, this would be the time we should have video for our show where you could have a puzzled look on your face and go, what?
Yeah. I mean, Chernobyl, for those of you who don't know, of course, there was a big giant nuclear reactor disaster there in the 80s.
1986, it is the worst nuclear disaster in history so far. And this is a nonfiction book about that. Now that the USSR has fallen, documents have been declassified, people can be interviewed. Adam Higginbotham has done a blow-by-blow description of how it all went down. It's fascinating. And it's just, some of it is so horrific, you laugh because otherwise you'll weep in despair. I mean, it's just, some of the details are just stunning. It is a remarkable book. And really, the disaster begins not with, you know, some human error on the day of the accident, but the actual design and building of the nuclear reactor, which was flawed from the start. People knew it, but you weren't allowed to talk about that sort of thing in the USSR. And there were disasters all over the Soviet Union in nuclear power plants, but each one of them was considered a state secret. So nobody heard about it, including other nuclear scientists and the people at other factories, nuclear facilities, where it might have helped to find out something went wrong and maybe we should do something different or maybe fix the design fault. No, not allowed to talk about it. So Chernobyl was inevitable. We're lucky it wasn't worse. But before you start to think, oh, it was this weird situation in a totalitarian state. No, we also had Fukushima and Three Mile Island. So, you know.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of my issue with the Chernobyls and those types of incidents. This is not something where you're like, oh, it only happened in the Ukraine and in that. I mean, there is a huge chunk of the Ukraine that you cannot visit because of Chernobyl right now.
Yeah, no, the contaminated zone is massive. The book is thrilling. There are a lot of great characters, people who behave horribly and nobly. And it could be a thriller. It could be a black comedy like Dr. Strangelove. It could be a miniseries. There's no end to what you could do with this property, but it is a fascinating work. Hopefully, maybe Russian television or in Ukraine, someone will tackle this and do a great work. This doesn't need to be in English language. I'd love to see it.
Now, so would I, actually.
But what you won't be able to see is Red Sonja, at least not at the moment, because we're moving on to sexual misconduct news.
Wait, what happened?
I just got notice that the Red Sonja film, to be directed by Bryan Singer, is now on hold. For a while there, they were saying, well, we're moving ahead. You know, he made a lot of money on Bohemian Rhapsody. And despite new allegations against him, the producers were holding firm and saying, no, got nothing to do with that. He's just our director. It's unproven. Now they're saying, Maybe we're going to have to put a hold on this. So that is the latest news for Bryan Singer.
And I guess there's some more news for Woody Allen. And at first when I saw this, you posted this in our sexual misconduct news. And I thought, well, how is this sexual misconduct news? It's more like legal news because Woody Allen was suing Amazon for kind of canceling their contract. They had an output deal, if you will, where Woody Allen would make movies for Amazon. And, you know, the movies didn't do that well. And I thought, well, maybe Amazon just...
No. Don't say the movies didn't do that well. Well... That's not the issue.
Well, that's... I'm saying that I thought that, well, the movies didn't do that well. So maybe, you know, they kind of turned around and went, well, you know, hey, your movies aren't doing well and we're canceling.
Well, why don't we talk about what's actually happening? First of all, Woody Allen is suing Amazon for $68 million.
That is happening.
He says Amazon simply refuses to release his new film, A Rainy Day in New York. They're just sitting on it. They don't want to do anything with it. He's like, put out my film. And he also says Amazon has backed out of its commitment to fund three more films by Woody Allen, hence the $68 million total that he's demanding from them. He says their claim that, you know, the allegations against him are the reason why they're breaking this. He says, no good. These are decades old allegations and they knew about them when they signed him to the deal. So no go on that one. That's an interesting legal point. That's a very good point.
I was going to say, from a legal standpoint, he is 100% correct. They knew everybody. It's not like, we didn't know about this. We didn't read the papers back in the 90s. No.
Right, but they, they could argue that there's more information that came forward or is now seen in a new light. You know, it is not in news to them, however, as he so clearly points out. And the fun thing to remember is that Roy Price was the Amazon exec who signed Woody Allen to a big overpriced deal, and he had to resign over allegations he sexually harassed a top female producer. So isn't it funny how it all comes around?
Well, I think I would imagine this is going to be settled. Okay.
Oh, and I'm sure.
We'll never know what really happened.
He doesn't want to go to court. They don't want to go to court. His movie should be seen. You know, why are you going to sit on it forever? That's a little crazy, but we'll see.
It'll be, what is the Orson Welles film that you can never, F is for fake. You can never see it.
No, you can see it. It's on Criterion.
Oh, okay. Well, I can't remember the name of the film that you can never see.
No. Well, The Other Side of the Wind has been released now.
Yeah, that's true. So it'll be like The Other Side of the Wind.
Exactly. It'll be a big whoop.
Oh, okay. Then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. Guess what? Actors really do contribute their talent to the creation of shows, and a new profit-sharing deal will reflect that. And by shows, we mean Broadway shows. Actors Equity had gone on strike over contracts for what are known as developmental labs. We talked about this on previous episodes. Now, developmental labs are workshops where new plays and musicals are put on their feet, worked on by all involved, and investors decide if they want to go forward or not. Typically, while other creatives would share in the spoils if a show went on to become a big hit, Hamilton, actors were seen as just hired hands, asked to read lines and sing a few songs. They weren't contributing to how a show was formed. The writers and directors were doing that. Actors Equity, you know, they kind of disagreed. They wanted an increase in salary for developmental labs, and if the show became a hit and showed a profit, they wanted the actors involved in those labs to split 1% of the profits after a show recouped its investment. They got everything they wanted, with Actors Equity cheering this groundbreaking agreement and the Broadway League grudgingly admitting they are glad the strike is over and everyone can get back to work. Now they have to call their accountants and figure out how they can hide all the profits. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a great deal. I thought they deserved it. I thought they should get it. There was no defense of why they wouldn't get it. They are contributing creatively. The weird thing is that this came out on Saturday night, and I don't know if it even has hit Variety and Hollywood Reporter yet. I think by now it must have. But for hours or a day or two, the Times was the only place I saw mentioning this until other people repeated what the Times said. And that just goes to show you the loss of reporters and people covering the theater business. There's just been a winnowing of people at all the trades and all the places, and there just isn't the same media coverage anymore. So it's a shame that, you know, Broadway's not getting the attention it deserves, and they don't have beat reporters staying on top of this stuff.
When I saw this story in the New York Times on Saturday, I thought, finally, I like raced and I pasted it into our show notes thinking I finally beat Michael. Yeah, no, he was already there. In any case, Spotify finally showed an operating profit in the fourth quarter of 2018. It only took 96 million paid users to get there. Total revenue was $1.7 billion, almost all of it from premium subscribers like Michael and myself.
Like me.
Yeah. Oh. Still, it's worth noting ad revenue in the quarter hit $200 million, a 34% increase over the same quarter 1 year earlier. But how long will it last? Spotify and all the other streamers are facing a big bump in costs. Songwriters in the U.S. will see a 44% increase in their royalties from paid streamers over the next 5 years. That's real money, by the way, and will take a big chunk out of any potential profits. And of course, it doesn't include YouTube, which will drive the streamers crazy. I'd guess a 44% rise in crazy, by the way, over the next 5 years. Big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. Finally showing a profit is definitely the step in the right direction. It makes it seem like it's almost impossible for anyone other than Apple to follow them. You know, it took so long and so much money, but the increase is the really big news, I think. That's a big royalty increase, and that is really going to come into play down the road. Maybe they've hit profitability for a quarter, but you have to assume they're going to fall right back again.
Well, and I guess my question then becomes, is it the record companies that have to pay that increase or Spotify? Because I would imagine it's the record companies. However, the record companies will turn to Spotify and say, hey, yeah, we need to increase our streaming rights.
Well, yeah. And Spotify is a big player, but really YouTube is the biggest player when it comes to new music and people listening to music. It's the best place to track what people are actually listening to because they have such a much bigger worldwide base. And when you look at the YouTube charts, which are probably in a way better than Spotify or Billboard at the moment, sorry, Billboard, when you look at their charts, that shows you what people are listening to worldwide. And there's been a fascinating change that people are talking about where English pop stars, people singing in English, are not dominating as much as they were. I think it's really healthy, but you're seeing Chinese and Korean and Arabic and other artists, French, you know, the charts are not dominated as much by English. Still a lot of them, of course, but you're seeing a much healthier mix of what people are listening to worldwide. And I think that's just going to help these stars become bigger and bigger. As Spotify goes into India, guess what? They're going to start promoting some of their biggest Indian stars back here because they're going to recognize, hey, this person can cross over.
Netflix had a great fiscal year. Speaking of good fiscal years or turning profits, it enjoyed record profits of $845 million. Congrats! Taking note of this success are people like Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or AOC as I like to call her, and perhaps, you know, voters. Are they cheering on a millennial-friendly company's success? Not quite. They're noticing that while Netflix enjoyed record profits, it somehow managed to pay virtually no federal or state income tax. Corporations have avoided paying their fair share of taxes for generations, but Netflix's success at doing so was boosted immeasurably by the new tax laws passed by Republicans and President Trump. Expect many other corporations to report similar successes as word gets out to the public. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, it'll be a big deal if people pay attention and get angry and stay focused on this. And that will help when they're filling out their taxes this April because people are going to find out, wow, I'm actually paying more in taxes. Middle class and working class people, they're not getting a big cut. They're going to be paying more. So, you know, the roosters, chickens may come home to roost. We'll have to see.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, this is almost, you could write this prediction, you know, a year ago when they passed this tax law, everybody said, hey, here's what's going to happen. The rich will get richer. And about a year from now, when people do their 2018 taxes, they're going to figure out, wait a second, I'm paying more. And right. Sure, I mean, enough, that's exactly what's happening.
I've been looking at corporate income tax in the United States. And, you know, in the late 30s, early 40s, personal income tax and corporate income tax contributed about the same amount to federal revenue. You know, they were the two biggest sources, of course. Now, it's not even close. Corporate revenue is about 7%. Corporate income tax contributes about 7% of the federal revenue, the money that the government takes in, rather than the 40 or 50% it used to be. And that's just crazy. You know, they're just not paying taxes. A third of all Fortune 500 companies don't pay any federal income tax in any given year. They're not paying their fair share. It's just, it's bad. It's not good.
Well, and you know who is paying it? That 7% comes mostly from small businesses who can't afford to figure out how not to pay taxes.
Exactly.
And in fact, I saw a movie at Sundance many years ago called We're Not Broke. And it was all about how, yes, we have a huge, deficit and we owe, you know, the national debt is huge. However, when you look at companies like GE and Apple and Google, they are literally, as you say, Michael, paying $0 in income taxes. In fact, yeah, getting billions of dollars back in refunds.
And of course, it's a worldwide problem because corporations will hide their money in Ireland or Bermuda, where I was born, and other places, and do whatever they have to avoid paying taxes. And when you go after them, they're going to feel like you're anti-business. But it's a big problem and needs to be dealt with. And I really do think entertainment businesses in Hollywood and elsewhere need to sort of try and face reality and say, we need to plan for the future. And maybe our CEO shouldn't get $80 million. Maybe we have to think about when we're going to start paying taxes again and paying our employees a better wage and things like that.
Well, now, speaking of international issues, China is feeling more growing pains with its film industry. The country wants a vibrant industry, but it doesn't want movies that challenge the status quo in any way, shape, or form. And that's not easy. Case in point, the Berlin Film Festival. First, the movie Better Days was yanked from the fest. The film is about disaffected youth and apparently hit a snag with Chinese censors. More embarrassingly, the world-famous director Zhang Yimou, his new film 1 Second, which is actually more than 1 second, has been pulled from the lineup at the last second. They're claiming technical issues, but everyone knows this film set during the Cultural Revolution must have hit a bit of a nerve. Big deal or big whoop?
This is a big deal, I think. You could just say, well, it's two movies. They'll probably show up eventually somewhere. But Zhang Yimou is as big a director as it gets in China. He's world famous. He's the guy who oversaw their Olympic triumph opening ceremonies. He's very well known. And yeah, you know, you just sort of squash one movie a little bit. It doesn't seem like a big deal compared to sort of the more systemic abuses going on in these countries. But this has a lot of blowback, and I think it really hurts their image worldwide, and I think it is a big problem and can really have a big long-term effect. So doing things like this in this day and age, it's not good, and I think it's going to be a real problem for them.
NBC enjoyed a smash hit with its live musical version of Jesus Christ Superstar, but they've had second thoughts about their next production, the rock musical Hair, since that flower power show features oddball skits, a strident anti-war attitude, cursing, and is most famous for nudity that NBC was never going to show anyway. They suddenly said, hey, you know, maybe Hair is not the family-friendly musical they're looking for, especially since they just did Rent, and that kind of wasn't the family fare they were looking for.
They've got No, there's nothing wrong with the content of Rent.
Well, they certainly edited it in certain ways. They censored it in different areas. They've got nothing, by the way. NBC has nothing on tap since Bye Bye Birdie has also been pulled. But NBC insists they will be doing more shows in the future. We just don't know what they are. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I think it was the right choice. I think we said at the time when they announced it, what a bad choice.
Right. We did say that.
I mean, it really made no sense. It's not that good a show, and it can be popular, but it does not make sense at all for primetime on NBC. But there's lots of great things they could do. I mean, I suppose ABC and Disney is going to have the rights to Beauty and the Beast, so they get to do that one. But they could do Ain't Misbehaving with Queen Latifah. They could do Annie. That's been done on TV, but a live version of Annie, that would be a killer. Anything by Rodgers and Hammerstein. I'm sure somebody's trying to get Bette Midler to do Hello, Dolly. They could do How to Succeed in Business with Darren Criss, 1776, Guys and Dolls, Annie, Get Your Gun. There's a million shows to choose from, so they shouldn't have any trouble finding a classic show that makes sense for them. But what did they censor from Rent? I don't recall anyone
saying
that.
Oh, it was just some of the lyrics. Some of the lyrics, they tweaked them a bit.
They didn't want to have cursing. Big deal.
Yeah. Now, bigger is better, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Two venue giants have merged to create an even bigger venue giant. AEG has merged with SMG. Apparently, to merge with AEG, you need a G in your name. They have merged to create a new company called ASM. Wait, what?
AEG and SMG became ASM. So they have all three letters in both names, so that makes sense.
Yes. Now, what will it control? Well, more than 300 venues, and they include NFL stadiums like Soldier's Field, NBA arenas, convention centers, and performing arts venues in North America, South America, Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. I have to pay now to get into my own house because they'll own that. artists are sure to get better terms and more favorable contracts. I wonder if that's actually true. And the result for consumers? Lower ticket prices and easier access to high-profile, high-demand events. That is what consumers will get. Oh, my nose just grew about 2 inches because I'm just kidding. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. And enter Senator Elizabeth Warren, whose platform involves a lot of antitrust. Should this be happening? I don't think so.
Yeah, no. It should not be happening. But Michael, that ends Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I'll tell you, at least for those in North America, you know, this week's segment, Inside Baseball segment, will definitely affect our listeners because they will get to subscribe to another movie subscription service if they'd like to. Our guest is Rafat Oyuz, the CEO and founder of Cinemia. Rafat, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jay. And Michael.
Well, thank you. Let me just say, I believe movie subscriptions work, and they're going to be a permanent part of the mix, probably all over the world. They've been working in the UK for years. They're working in the U.S. At least they're popular. The trick, of course, is to make it profitable for the company as well as the consumers. But let me put it this way. I'm a subscriber to Cinemia, and I would never spend, in this day and age, $360 on tickets going to the movie. And that means when I live in New York City, that means going to about 20 movies a year. I probably wouldn't do that. But when I pay $30 a month, I am very happy and excited to go see a lot more movies than 20 a year because I have a desire to. It's just pretty darn expensive. So, you know, I think it's a subscription. I think it's an idea that'll work. What made you plunge into the business?
Well, I think you describe it real well because I think it was 5 years ago, 4.5. We found that in Europe, and we are right now in 5 countries. So we've been operating for 5 countries for the last 5 years. We entered the United States in 2017, we can talk about that. But why we start is actually the same that you said. Like, I was listening more music because of subscription services, and I figured out that it's great because I listen more and I actually give more chance to the new musics that I will not gonna give a chance if I'm paying for one by one like decades ago. So now I was because I'm coming from the financial institutes and like I was managing like banks and the digital worlds, the biggest digital worlds in Europe. So I figured out that maybe we can do this in the movie ticket service because movie tickets is actually like offline business. It's not digital, not like Netflix. So there's like Netflix streaming, music streaming, but there's no movie tickets. So I said we can use the debit cards because every movie theater using debit cards. And if I can figure out to get more money from the advertising and all the like near segments like restaurants and like shoppings, because whenever you go to movies, you eat something before, like with your families or friends, or you drink something, you go out and shop. So, and you ride. So that's why we have a integration with Uber. So we had an app that gives you also discounts and gives you like the advertising that you can like, and gives you 3 tickets a month, almost a $10. So, and this is why it can be sustainable, but also this is why I built this, we built this dream. Now we're having in 5 countries, but we are actually expanding a lot more with the Cinema Enterprise, but we can talk more about that. But basically, yes, we are helping to disrupt the industry and actually helping to evolve the industry with the movie theaters.
Well, so let me ask, you're saying that you're going to make money off of the subscription service itself, okay? And you started in I guess finance, in credit cards, so you operate from a credit card, if I'm not mistaken.
Debit card.
But you're also, of course, going to be making money off of whether it's somebody taking an Uber ride, which you're already integrated with, or somebody shopping, maybe going to a restaurant afterwards. You also plan to earn revenue from that. Have you started to do that already?
Yes, we are already taking a lot of advertising from streaming companies and from the studios. We have a big major studio partnerships in the year, last year. We don't even only advertise there. Like a new release on theaters, but like we have with like some major movie studios, we have an arrangement to advertise their home video or like their digital video. They can just purchase their the movies that are already in the streaming phase. They can buy and watch it through the cinema. Like they can buy the through the cinema, but they can watch it in the streaming services. But what we are doing is giving the audience the best choice and also giving the studios the best audience.
So you're in Turkey, I assume, and the United States. What other countries are you in and which one will be next?
Well, we are mostly in, so we, our headquarters in LA, Los Angeles. So we're in LA, but also we found in Europe, as you said, we are in UK, we're in Australia, and we are in Canada. The US is the biggest, Canada is the second, Australia, UK, Australia, Turkey, and UK. Yeah.
Okay. So now you've picked the $30 price point in the United States. You have You're making some money from these other areas, but I'm assuming it's not a majority of where your profits come yet. If you make no money anywhere else, can you break even on $30? Do you think you can, or will you break even once you have enough people who don't go to movies the way I do, which is, you know, three or four or five a month?
Well, yes, that's a good catch. Well, what we build is here, whenever you had the more customers, you get more advertising, you get more integrations, and you get more. So it's correlated, but I can assure you, like, our Europe operations, which is like almost 5 years long, old, and we are having good gross margins and positive EBITDA, and like we're a really healthy business order. Over here is like going better and better, and we're gross margin positive, but we are going to build more and more. It's about the business. Like every startup going in this way, like Spotify, they reached the EBITDA positive this year, actually this quarter, so last quarter.
And EBITDA is, for those who don't know, earnings before income taxes and depreciation.
Yeah, they finally made a little money.
Are you profitable or not?
Yeah.
Spotify just reached the profitable just this year, about 10 years later after their foundation. And actually after their IPO. That's where the world is going. You should think that you should have a plan. So I can tell you, like when we come here in 2017, our competitor they were smaller than us at the time. So they were like a 20K customer or something, and they changed their model to $9 for unlimited. And since we are coming from the five country and having those data, we thought that we could never make money on that level to make it sustainable. So we didn't go on that level. We maintained two movie tickets or three movie tickets per $9.99. While our competitor were giving unlimited for $9.99, all my investors asked, are you going to do this? And I said, we can't, because it doesn't really feasible. We can't make it. So you should have a plan to make it sustainable. So that's what we are always going through. And as you said, as you can see now, competitors don't have the unlimited model. They have the actually same model with us, three movie tickets that we are always saying. But we still have some plus, which you can take the advanced tickets, which you can't in the competitor. You can reserve your seat even 30 days before. So that's a good thing for our customers. But also we have family plans that no one has. You can buy family plans and couple plans, and you can go with them. And you have 3D and IMAX plans, but they're coming to this level, the competitors as well. But We were the first one offering the 3D and IMAX and 4DX and more. We still have the only 4DX, but yeah, that's we are more, and now we have a rollover from the last week. As you can see, the Cinemark has the rollover feature, and we are, which is good, and we are offering for all the movie theaters, and it's free. So one movie ticket is rolling over every month if you don't use it. And you can use it next month for every customers, existing and the new customers.
Right. To clarify, it's sort of like the plans in the UK. There are basically for Cinemia, there are no restrictions. You can use it at any theater, which means in New York, I can go to revival houses like Film Forum and IFC, which is really important to me. And if I want to see a movie in 3D, I can. There are no dates or time restrictions. And most importantly, you can book in advance. So if there's a big movie and you want to go with friends, you don't have to wait to the day of and physically go to the theater. You can actually just book it, you know, a week or a month in advance. Those are all great things, and that's all really a big positive. I know Sperling wants to ask a question about movie theater chains, because I know they're nervous about subscription services.
Oh, they love movie theater subscription services, 100%, he said sarcastically. How are you pitching this to movie theater chains? I guess AMC has their own. Cinemark, you've already mentioned, has their own subscription services. Regal, I can only imagine, is about to launch theirs.
That's true.
And so what are you saying to them to kind of ease their fears and maybe bring them on board?
So I'm just going to tell you that that's something that we launched October, which is Cinemia Enterprise. So basically, we didn't have those, we didn't get any bad reviews or bad relationship with the movie theaters. I think that wasn't supposed to going us. That was supposed to going some I don't know, competitors, which are we think that also that the devaluing the movie tickets, because there should be some price point you can continue. So that if we go our side, I can tell you we're really good with movie theaters, including the big ones. We talk, we give suggestions to each other. So what we do is we now partner with movie theaters to build their own movie ticket subscriptions, and using the Cinemia APIs, and we build their platform end to end. So we do their app, we do their website with payment controls and fraud controls, geofencing.
And which chain are you doing that with?
So we just said there was an article from the TechCrunch and a couple Engadget or Business Insider that says that because it's actually public information, so Nation Amusements showcase subscribe and Studio Movie Girl, their Studio Movie Girl Access app, they're both powered by Cinemia, and which is a public information, and we already signed more than 10 movie theaters, including most of them is actually coming from the United States, but they're including from the Asia, South Africa, South America. So there's a lot of interest, and we're going to build their apps and their systems over the world, and it's going really well. We just launched it in October, and we already signed more than 10. So it's actually a good sign of, and we already signed it. We already launched two of the top 10 movie theater chains in the United States. So I can say that it's going well, and it's encouraging. Yeah.
So just to kind of clarify, you're basically building not AMC and Cinemark, but Studio Movie Grill and National Amusements.
Well, I can't say that what we are not, but so.
But
say that what we are not, because we are NDAs or something. But I can say that what is actually public information. Yeah.
Right, and so at least those two theaters, you're kind of giving them a subscription service, and they're just using your back end and your technology.
Everything from the from the end to end. Yeah, back end and front end. Yeah.
Are you talking to theater chains about getting a discount on tickets? Once you reach a certain level of customers and you're buying a certain number, are you saying, hey, could we get a dollar or two off the list price?
It is more likely, it is not our business strategy right now. No, okay. We try to get the money from the other sectors, because we're debit card and credit card company, so we can actually make money from the credit card itself. That's our strategy. That's what we're doing. Mm-hmm.
And so just to understand, if I'm a Cinemia subscriber, and Michael, you are, so maybe you can probably walk us through this. I have an app, I get a credit card, and do I use them in conjunction with one another, or do I just use the credit card?
Well, yes, to explain, you always have to go to another source to actually buy the ticket. So you begin on the Cinemia app, and then you can either buy it through another app, which means you might pay a fee unless you're a member of AMC or something. And if you want to avoid the fee, you can get a physical debit card, in which case you use that physically at the theater. So it's your choice. I usually end up being at the theater and using the physical debit card, but you can also just buy it through Atom Tickets or another website that offers movie tickets. So you're on your app, you go to a third-party app or use the physical Cinemia debit card, and then you have to go back to your app to check in when you're at the theater.
So, and do I pay anything else other than the monthly fee?
Well, you can. If you use a third-party app, you might pay the fee, if there is any, for using that service. You know, Atom Tickets might charge you $1 or $1.50. But I, for example, am a member of AMC. I pay $20 a year. So if I use the AMC app to buy a ticket, I don't pay a fee. And if I do it through Atom, I don't pay a fee because I'm an AMC member. And if you use the physical card, you don't pay an extra fee. You are just, using the thing.
And so there's no upcharge for seeing, say, a 3D movie or a Yeah, I guess 3D would be the...
Yeah, there is no upcharge. However, you do always pay a Cinemia charge per ticket, correct, Refat?
Yes, yes.
Yes, so even if you use a physical card, even if you show up at the theater, you will always be paying
there's no dollar fee. If you're not paying fee, there's no fee for Cinemia.
Yeah.
So just to understand, so I would pay my $30 per month, but then I would pay for each ticket individually as well.
No, it's like if you want to buy the advance ticket, there's fee for every like provider. That's like that's actually how the world goes. Like that's the how you buy the advance ticket. Right now, if you go to without Cinemia, if you go any website, you pay $1.50 or something like that, a fee, sometimes $2 fee to that provider. It doesn't change with Cinemia. It's same, but because of that fee, we have a like payment transaction fee. But let's think that you have the physical card and you're going to box office. In the normal world, you don't pay extra fee, and in the Cinemia, you don't pay extra fee. So the only case that you pay extra fee is that if you're paying the extra fee in the normal world. So it's actually that's how it works. Like we only
so it's a convenience fee.
In box office as a like debit card, you don't pay any extra fee, just a monthly fee.
Okay, that makes sense.
Now, how big a problem is fraud?
That is something really important in the financial institutions. So since we are giving you a debit card, we need to really take care of the fraud. And I think this is really important for the movie ticket subscriptions and the future of movie ticket subscriptions. I heard a lot of stories about the other competitors too, which like you can see in the Reddit or more. So this is really important. We have the team for it, and we regularly check the IDs. We regularly have the system improvements for the geofencing. But because we need to keep this sustainable business to the real moviegoers, so there's always like fraud and fraud relation transactions in the in the finance sector, like PayPal or Venmo. They're both have the budget for fraud, and they trying to decrease that amount. That's same with us. That's not different because we are in the debit card business more than entertainment business.
Mm-hmm. Well, here come the tough questions. I think one of the worst problems with MoviePass was their customer service until they started making it impossible for you to actually see a movie. But before that, it was customer service. You have no live customer service yet. Are you planning to ever add that?
No, because it's actually we had that in Europe over here too, but we saw that it's feasible to get an email. And it's more important to focus to solve problems and not having in the same not having it at the first place. So that's main problem. But we almost double our customer service for the last 2 months, double every month. So we are increasing our customer service since we are increasing in the customer user base. So as a growing company, it will be every time a problem, but I see that right now we are actually going to resolve it. Like our scores in everywhere is keep increasing every week. Mm-hmm. I don't know, BBBB and Trustpilot and everywhere we are actually increasing every week. So that's a good sign. That's where we look the feedbacks.
Okay. Well, I use Cinemia. I like it. I really love that I can go to every theater in New York City. I have probably sent about a dozen emails to the company, and I have only received one response ever.
Respond? You didn't have the response. You used the Cinemia email, really?
Yes, absolutely. But I also have another request. When you are physically at a movie theater, your app will know that. And if you're there, an hour or two before the showtime, your app will know that. And you get approval for a movie, and then you have to go to a third-party app. I feel like if you're already there physically and you're activating the card, the physical card, which you can't do unless you're actually there at the theater, I feel like you could skip that final process of checking in, because it's very hard to remember you're on Cinemia. You have to leave it in order to buy a ticket. And then you have to remember to go back again, even though you've already used your card and you've got the ticket. I have repeatedly failed to forget it. And I understand if it's a day before or you're not physically at the location and you've purchased the ticket via online. But if you're actually at the theater already, when you turn on the app and you get the credit card turned on, it feels like you've already checked in. So why you have to check in twice? I'm hoping you'll see that that just creates problems for the customers. And I don't see how that would solve any fraud issue because you're already there.
I think we just opened that process. So we are keep improving that process. And I will actually like forward that in the product team. But there is actually some fraud issues and also like some issues that we have to use our way so that like everyone should their own way to actually have the property something. There's also related to property rights. Mm-hmm. So we need to have the different ways to approach this. So okay. Everyone has their own property rights on this. So that might be related to that too. Like it's a little bit complicated, but we are improving that process. It's actually almost like 2 months old, as you said, for that process, but we're improving that process. I will forward that. And I will look at why your email is not reaching us because it's, I think it could be like spam related or something.
Now here's the toughest question of all. And that is, you launched in 2017 in the US and it's now, February 2019. What has the uptake been like? How many customers are using the Cinemia?
Well, I can say that since we're not a public company and all the others are, we're not sharing our numbers because we don't want them to see the other markets' numbers. But I can easily say that we are almost number one in the United States. So I don't know the others, like some of them updates numbers. We are proud to be growing every month. Right now, for the even last two, like this low season, we're growing 20%, and for the last 14 months, we grow like 50% month over month. So we're happy to grow, and we're happy to grow in North America mostly because that's where the growth is coming. Europe, we're old, but like that's we doubled last year, so. That's what's the current numbers right now.
And what was the last movie you saw in a theater?
I think the Glass. Yeah, Glass.
Good answer. A number one movie for a few weeks and a sort of movie that people might have taken a chance on that I wouldn't necessarily go see. But with Cinemia, that's a movie I would go see.
Yes, that's what we want. We want you to go to give a chance. The movies that you actually will not going to give a chance if you pay one by one. And then that's how we will increase the movie going. That's what our mission is.
Well, Rafat, thank you very much for taking the time to join us to explain everything having to do with Cinemia, a movie subscription service, not only in the US, but as we've learned elsewhere in the world, like the United Kingdom, Turkey, and Australia and Canada. And we will send people to cinemia.com to subscribe if they happen to be in those countries.
Thank you very much, Jay. Thank you for having me.
Well, that was good of Rafat to join us here. I can't tell you how satisfying it is. I like Cinemia, but there are some things that drive me nuts about the actual use of it. Having to check in twice is so infuriating when you're at the theater. You're like, because you always forget and they go, well, you got to pay for your ticket. You got to pay for the ticket if you forget to check in twice. You check in, you have to leave the app and go somewhere else, and then you have to check in again. It's just infuriating. And so being able to get the guy on the phone who runs the company and tell him about it, it's very nice. So I'm glad we have this podcast.
Yeah, anytime, Michael. Somebody who will not be starring in any more movies is Albert Finney, who died at the age of 82 this past week.
That's right. He's a terrific actor, stage and screen. He was nominated for the Oscar 5 times. He won an Emmy for playing Churchill, as we all eventually will. We'll all win something for playing Winston Churchill. He won it for playing him in the TV film The Gathering Storm. He was, of course, a Tony and a BAFTA nominee. Not a BAFTA, but a Tony and a Olivier nominee, or whatever it was called at the time. But terrific actor. Lots of great movies. Tom Jones, The Dresser. He broke through with, a kitchen sink drama Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. Miller's Crossing, my favorite Coen Brothers film, Under the Volcano, Aaron Brockovich, Murder on the Orient Express, Shoot the Moon, Annie, nobody's perfect, you know. He did that, Annie. You know, there's two conflicting ideas of him. One thing said, oh, he squandered his talent and just went after the big paycheck. But that doesn't make any sense because, on the other hand, he sort of resisted fame. He turned down an OBE. He turned down a knighthood. He turned down Lawrence of Arabia because he didn't want to be tied down to a 5-year contract with the producers of the film. So that role went, of course, to Peter O'Toole.
And, I wonder if he ever regretted that.
You know, he seems the kind of guy who just sort of like, you know, it happened. And certainly had big hits. He had a big hit with Tom Jones. And after he broke through with Tom Jones in terms of commercial, he became critically acclaimed in the film Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. And then he did Tom Jones, which was a big hit, got lots of Oscar nominations, big box office, made him a star, as big a star as he would ever be. When that happened, he took a year off to go sailing. So that's not a guy pursuing fame and fortune.
No,
you know, that is
all.
A guy who is very comfortable saying, I want to live my life. So I feel like that's the true take on Albert Finney. A lot of great roles. I still have never seen Under the Volcano. I want to read the book and watch the movie, and I will.
And one of my favorite Albert Finney movies, Two for the Road.
Oh, yes, with Audrey Hepburn.
Correct. And a Henry Mancini score, in fact.
Oh, well, there you go. So let's pretend the Henry Mancini score is playing us off as we say goodbye to our listeners.
Okay, well, in that case, let me tell you that you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us, rate and review us in those podcast aggregators. It helps us out when you do. It helps other people find the show when you do that. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as links to Cinemia. And I'd like to thank Rafat Oyuz once again for joining us to tell us about Cinemia. You can also email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We can be found on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Gills has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
And the website I want you to go to this week is freeonesecond.cn.
Oh, you're talking about the, okay, I know it. This is the Zhang Yimou movie, and .cn, of course, is the top-level domain for China.
Exactly.
Okay, well, if you can't find...
Oh, 2 weeks, not 1 week. Oh.
What are you talking about?
Well, I'm not going to get to speak to you next week. No show next week.
That's
true.
We're
not doing a show next week. You're going to be gone. Who am I going to talk to? I have no friends.
Well, you know what? Maybe everybody should go to michaelgiltz.com to find out all of Michael's entertainment coverage, or, you know, they could go to bookfilter.com to know what they should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com in the meantime, you know, and you know, if while you're there, you know, say hello to Michael. In the meantime, until 2 weeks from now, play nice.